Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Olive on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. This year, there have been renewed discussion of the value of some of our nation's statues and monuments. Confederate monuments, statues of Christopher Columbus, have faced additional scrutiny as we think deeply about whom and what is worthy of memorialization. Even one of Thomas Jefferson's own descendants questions the need for the renowned Jefferson Memorial. Our next guest maintains there's a distinct difference between a monument and a memorial. And while monuments might confer undeserved importance or adulation on a historical figure, memorials, at their best, encourage visitors to reflect and remember. Spencer Bailey is the former editor-in-chief of Surface Magazine and the co-host of the Time Sensitive podcast. In his new book, In Memory of Designing Contemporary Memorials, Spencer examines the architecture of the most powerful memorials around the world and explains how their abstract designs evoke emotion in the visitor. It is a beautiful book, and you can order a copy now from your, we're just going to say, indie booksellers. Let's go there. And Spencer Bailey joins me now to discuss. Hi, Spencer.
Hi, Allison. It's great to be here.
And listeners, you can find some images of the memorials we'll be discussing on our Instagram page, at @allofitwnyc. So, Spencer, you opened this book with such a personal story about there's a statue that depicts you as a child. It became part of a memorial because you survived this devastating plane crash. It's a photo from 1989, a man carrying three-year-old you, away from the wreckage of United Airlines Flight 232. This photo circulated widely. You and one of your brothers survived the crash. Sadly, your mother was among the 112 people killed. And the statue looks remarkably like the photo. What do you see when you look at that memorial?
I don't see myself, which I sort of note in the book. And I don't see myself because in a way it's been hard to even remove, you know, myself from that image. Mm-hmm. It's been quite a fascinating sort of journey to understand that image in a greater context, which is really what this book was about. And the only reason I don't see myself in, and I should clarify, I don't see myself in the statue, even though it's very clear that it's me in the image. Mm-hmm. The statue has come to represent something far different, something, you know, I understand its power to represent something far greater than myself, and that I also, you know, the image of me being carried kind of serves as a image of hope, but it's not clear cut in its message, and it's really, I think, that fact that there's an idea underlying the figurative statue that is just totally misrepresented in what it's trying to say. It's almost like the image becomes biblical almost in a way. It becomes something that is about a hero story. It's reflective of something that is not about the multitude of experiences that happened that day. It's really just about one story or a hero story. That's sort of what the book goes into, is that there is a power in understanding the multitude mm-hmm. of stories, and that figurative statues tend to often dictate. They tend to have one definition or maybe a handful of definitions as opposed to dozens. And that's the point. These monuments are trying to weave a specific definition of something by the creators of them, as opposed to allow us to bring our own human weight, our own human baggage to something. I liked what Brian Washington was saying on the segment before about why he decided to name his novel Memorial. And it's this idea of flexibility. Memorials at their best can offer flexible and sort of metaphorical understanding, something that's much broader than you know, something that's figurative and saying, well, look at this. This is important.
Okay, so with all of that in our brains, what's an example of, you think, is an effective modern memorial and why? Just to give a baseline for our audience before we go into details.
Of course. I mean, I think the one that immediately comes to mind for me, which was incredibly affecting when I visited about a year ago, was the Memorial for Peace and Justice. Mm-hmm. It's in Montgomery, Alabama, designed by Mass Design Group, and it's part of Brian Stevenson's Equal Justice Initiative. The reason I bring this memorial up is because, well, for one thing, I think every single American should go visit it and be required to visit it, frankly. Mm-hmm. But also because it shows the power of abstraction in a way that I think is, you know, something that all of us can really understand. Like, it would be hard. I'd be hard pressed to find an American who goes and visits that memorial and isn't somehow affected. I guess I should describe. It's hard to describe physical things in an audio format, but I'll give my best shot. Basically, when you arrive at this memorial, you follow this procession upwards toward a central pavilion, and the central pavilion is all of these pillars. They're quite compressed, and as you walk down this procession, the pillars begin to raise, and so you're walking downwards, and it's sort of down toward this water feature, and you notice all of a sudden your neck is craning up, and it's craning up in a way that isn't necessarily comfortable, and that's exactly the point. I think the subject matter is not comfortable. It's about America's lynching history and the history of slavery, really, and understanding that in an intimate way. Each pillar is meant to represent a county, and marked on each pillar are the names of those who were lynched in those counties. And it's something that I think that combination of abstraction with specificity. So there's the names, there's the lists, there's the counties. You get to really understand the magnitude and the weight of this thing while also experiencing it in physical space. And I think that that's a really important thing to mention is there's this sort of idea of commemorative justice happening through this very thing. I actually, you know, think it's worth mentioning that Hua Su in The New Yorker recently wrote this beautiful piece on the idea of commemorative justice. And what he's basically talking about is this notion that we all need to really look at these things not as, when talking about memorialization, it's not about, oh, do we need another statue? Instead of a monument or a figurative statue, we should really be thinking about these sorts of environments or spaces as portals. I kind of love this idea. It's mm-hmm. like, you know, it's basically what my book is about, and the memorials in the book are, is portals. It's offering us a place to interact with an environment, but also turn inward toward ourselves and to understand our own place in this grand scheme of things.
My guest is Spencer Bailey. The name of the book is In Memory of Designing Contemporary Memorials. And reminder, if you go to our Instagram page at @allofawnyc, you can see the memorial that is at the EJI Institute, as well as the one we were discussing regarding the statue of the picture, in case you want a visual for yourself. Can we talk about who gets a say in memorial design, Spencer? Because this is something that is a little bit sticky and can be a little bit tricky. There's a case in the book, you talk about the Judenplatz Holocaust Memorial in Vienna, which was designed by a British artist, and you note her name is Rachel Whitehead. Rachel Whitehead brought a neutral voice to a weighty, complex matter. Are there ways that memorial design can benefit from being created by someone who is not emotionally tied to the event?
I think it can. And that's actually one of my favorite memorials in the book. I think it's an incredibly powerful memorial because it's located in this central square in Vienna And designed in such a way as to be really evocative. The Mass Design Group Memorial I mentioned earlier is also incredibly evocative. It causes you to ponder it on multiple levels. The White Reed Memorial in Vienna that you mentioned, mm-hmm. it's basically shaped like a library, and all the books are turned inwards, so you don't know what the books are, and you're kind of referencing. You're kind of wondering what are these books, and you're kind of trying to understand the context of this structure in the middle of this very kind of traditional Vienna square. And there's two big doors, concrete doors at the front of this structure, missing doorknobs, and you're wondering where did the doorknobs go, and it kind of leaves you on the outside wondering what's going on the inside. And there's this sort of I think this power of the ability for a memorial to not to leave a sense of mystery, to leave a sense of not knowing, but also something that's so specific, as in the lists of the names of the concentration camps that lined the walls of this memorial, or at the entrance, the text at the entrance really illustrates the exact reason and power of the memorial. And there's a Star of David there as well. So, you know, I think that there's this notion that if we allow ourselves to respond to the abstraction, it will give us more internal dialogue necessarily than external dialogue. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes I find monuments or figurative statues, it's really about external dialogue. It's the world or specifically someone in power, often a politician or, a particular group of people trying to dictate or tell us what to think or tell us this is important, rather than say, yeah, this is a part of our history that we need to acknowledge and we need to address and we need to think about. But we can think about it as a story with multiple layers. We can think about it as something that carries a multitude of meanings and experiences and should really be thought of in metaphorical terms, or at least understood as metaphor, understood that we can address and we can explore, and we can enter this sort of idea from multiple angles and understand it from multiple experiences.
That's one of the most stunning memorials I've seen is the Oklahoma City, where the Murrah building was blown up by Timothy McVeigh. And it seems to be the work of many stakeholders, that a lot of people came together and were able to help create something that's really, really stunning. How were they successful in this? Because sometimes when you get a lot of stakeholders together, it won't work. People can't agree.
I wish I had a simple answer for that one, and I completely agree with you. I mean, what's also really incredible about that memorial is how quickly it was mm-hmm. built. It was completed in 2000, just 5 years after the bombing. And I'm glad you bring that one up, because I think it relates very much to the Flight 232 memorial, the one with the Spirit of Siouxland statue depicting my 3-year-old body. There was a near identical image from that crash. From the image of me in the crash is near identical to the image of Bailey Allman, who was a 1-year-old girl being carried by Chris Fields, a firefighter. And Chris Fields, of course, resembles Lieutenant Colonel Dennis Nielsen, who was carrying me, and I resemble the 1-year-old Bailey. The big difference, of course, is Bailey Allman is not alive. And when I visited the Oklahoma City Memorial, I came across a display in the museum that has that famous image of Bailey Allman being carried, and next to it there's a small marble statue by a sculptor named Miles Slater that's not designed as a centerpiece by any means. It's more of an artifact among many in the museum, and I think that's a good thing. I mean, I don't think that it should have been created as a centerpiece, as is the case at the Flight 232 memorial. And, you know, the reason I think it's important to mention this is that there is this beautiful abstract water feature at the Oklahoma Memorial with chairs, these sort of Donald Judd-like chairs arranged on a grassy pitch. And each chair is meant to be a sort of marker or even a gravestone of somebody who did not make it that day. I've never seen chairs that carry deeper meaning than those chairs. And I say this as someone who is a design editor of a design magazine. So I come from, having a kind of a strange deep knowledge of chairs. And those chairs, I think, are the most powerful chairs that I've ever come across in the world. The idea that they represent people in this way of, you know, through an object that we can all relate to. We sit in chairs every day.
And those people were sitting in chairs.
Exactly.
It was 9 o'clock in the morning. I mean, it's such a breathtaking memorial.
And they're arranged in between these two large sort of Arc de Triomphe like entryways, one of which says 901 and the other says 903, and all the chairs are arranged in the middle, basically referencing the number that's not there, 902, when the explosion happened.
My guest is Spencer Bailey. The name of the book is In Memory of Designing Contemporary Memorials. Of course, you know, we have to talk about Maya Lin's Vietnam Memorial. What, you know, traditionally, what were war memorials like before Maya Lin's work? And how much of a game changer was that?
It's impossible to understate how much of a game changer. I mean, and also the fact that Maya was a Yale University student who was taking a funerary architecture course and submitted her proposal, anonymously to this competition and won. So, you know, she was a new generation, a new mindset coming at how to think about how we remember. But this was also coming, you know, in the wake of World War II, where architects and artists were increasingly exploring non-figurative forms. You know, following World War I and II, you had the rise of the counterculture in the 60s and 70s. You had the evolution of abstract art and minimalism. There was a greater sophistication happening in psychology. You had terms like post-traumatic stress disorder becoming a part of the mainstream. Add to that shifts in religion and spirituality, how we mourn, the rise of victim culture, especially in the U.S. You know, all of this created this sort of perfect storm for memorialization. And I think, you know, to answer your first question, the idea of the monument stems back very far. You could argue that the pyramids and, so much of what our national mall is based on are European ideas or ideas stolen from other cultures, the obelisk. Thinking about monuments as something that was definitely more related to war and politics and was about victory and valor, it was the man on the horse with the sword. And, you know, sort of, I think that day is numbered. I don't think it's going to disappear, but I do think that memorials, especially as I'm sort of defining them post-Vietnam veterans memorial, are these spatial and abstract places and spaces that allow us to recognize collective hardship, to understand trauma and tragedy and survival and violent death and, you know, in the case of 9/11, terrorism, things that, I think before were kind of shunned or ignored at the sacrifice of, you know, politics, really. I mean, it was about trying to, the monument was really built as a show of power, whereas I think memorials are really built as a show of collectivity, of all of us being interconnected as a species.
The name of the book is In Memory of Designing Contemporary Memorials. Spencer Bailey has been my guest. Spencer, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. It was really great to be here, Allison.
This is all of it.